Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. As it addressed issues concerning substance abuse, one thing the state never had were Wyoming-specific numbers on the financial impact of substance abuse. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports that a recent study has found that the cost of alcohol, tobacco, and drug abuse is staggering.
If our number was randomly drawn for a public opinion poll about some issues affecting your community, would you be able to help me?
This is the Wyoming Survey and Analysis Center, or WISAC. Today, people in the state are being asked about their tobacco use.
And how old were you when you first smoked at least one cigarette every day for 30 days in a row? 16, okay.
Recently, WISAC was asked to determine the economic impact of substance abuse in the state. They were to look at healthcare costs, productivity losses, and other effects on society, such as costs of crime and road accidents. Research scientist Humphrey Costello says they looked at 2010 Wyoming numbers.
Alcohol costs Wyoming society, $843 million a year. That's a huge, huge number. For tobacco, it's $689 million. For drug abuse, it's $391 million. I think hearing those numbers lets one recognize how much we're all paying to deal with the consequences of abuse.
And just to be clear, the data got Costello's attention.
The burden's staggeringly large. Yeah, it's huge.
Fellow researcher Nanette Nelson says when they went into the study, there was an expectation that tobacco would have the biggest societal impact to the state.
Initially, our data was looking at the hospital and healthcare costs, and tobacco was rising to the top. And then when we started looking at productivity losses, you know, alcohol just galloped along, and it was surprising to us that alcohol came out as large as it did.
Nelson says the biggest impact substance abuse has on Wyoming is the loss of productivity.
So we have folks that come into work, they're slightly impaired. They're not as productive as folks that don't abuse alcohol, drugs, or even smoke cigarettes. They also show that they're often more sick, so there's more absenteeism.
While the researchers were surprised by the negative impact alcohol abuse has on the state, Wyoming Chronic Disease and Substance Abuse Project Manager Keith Hodel says it puts a number on something those in the prevention community have been seeing for a while. He says they know that Wyoming has high levels of binge drinking and driving while drunk, but he had no idea the societal impact of alcohol was quite this big.
We've always known it's a problem, and we've have devoted significant resources to dealing with it. But I think now when you step back and look at these numbers, you can say, well, it's as important as we always thought it was.
But while the alcohol numbers are staggering, so is the cost of tobacco and drugs.
You know, we have a culture that really is founded on an individual's right to choose to do whatever they want to do as long as they're not hurting someone else. And I think that this kind of study looks, you know, at the big issue and say, well, understand that there is a social cost outside of yourself that's related to that.
You could look at the report and wonder if prevention efforts have been working, but Hodel is far from discouraged. He says the fact that alcohol surpasses tobacco probably shows that tobacco prevention efforts have been working. He sees this new information as a way to focus their prevention efforts. Tony Cervenka is the director of the Prevention Management Organization of Wyoming. She says the report backs up their efforts.
My takeaway is that what we're doing in prevention is of utmost importance, and I feel that it really does justify the money that we're spending.
She also agrees with Hodel that focusing on some key areas will help reduce the overall cost of substance abuse.
Preventing youth initiation to alcohol would bring this total down a great deal.
Researchers Nanette Nelson and Humphrey Costello say that this Wyoming-specific data is important and should give state leaders critical information they need to set policy. And one last note, while the numbers are eye-catching, they say that they are on the conservative side, so it's possible the costs could be even greater than their report suggests. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
For years, Wyoming has been timid when it comes to gambling. But things might be changing with a casino on the Wind River Reservation, an increase in poker clubs, and the recent passage of a lottery bill. Now, many are wondering how far this issue will go. Wyoming Public Radio's Sarah Hosseini has more.
This is the Warehouse Poker Club in Laramie. It boasts a concrete exterior with no address in sight. When you arrive, the painted door is haloed by the telltale blue light of poker clubs everywhere. Inside, there are two things that might surprise you. The crowd is eclectic, and the atmosphere is rather cozy. There are a couple of pool tables, a tidy kitchenette, mounted elk heads, and the Zen fish tank. Everyone that walks in gets greeted by name. They're here because they like to play, and because they like to win. One University of Wyoming professor says that the average take-home varies.
It can vary from 100 to 8 or 9 if you just have an awesome night.
You won $900 before?
Yeah. Mike was lying about every time he gets down. Come on.
Once a year you get lucky.
Sell that to the rookies. One and two, blinds up, please.
Founder Gabe Schwager is a psychology student at UW who can't mask his enthusiasm for the game. He says he started the place 2 years ago because he was tired of driving to Cheyenne and wanted a convenient place to get together with the guys.
We're going to have everybody from college students to business owners to university professionals, PhDs, unemployed guys. There's no predicting who's going to show up. When it's in the midst of it, it's a beautiful thing to behold. You get to see the construction worker outplay the PhD, you know, outthink that guy and triumph over him. And that's what makes the game so great.
There are many such games, as he calls them, around the state that tread legally, albeit cautiously. Poker clubs are supposed to be strictly social events. Though tipping is allowed, the law states that the house cannot take a rake from winnings, can't advertise, and that all players must have a bona fide social relationship. Schwager says navigating that legislation can be difficult.
Bona fide social relationship is an ambiguous term. What is a documentable social relationship? I would like to see it a little bit more clear cut. It's always, like I said, if it was, I wouldn't be having to make those weekly calls to my attorney.
Nevertheless, Schwager hopes the casual Wyoming poker scene stays that way.
It's taken off. There's an article in Card Player magazine that says Wyoming poker is some of the best in the country right now.
What about it?
Well, just the niche that it provides. You know, if you go down to Phoenix or Milwaukee, you're going to see a lot of strip mall poker rooms.
Wyoming Senator Bruce Burns of Sheridan says he supports the local poker clubs, but he'd like to see even more gaming here.
The advantage would be money. And if I were suddenly emperor, the casinos, there would be casinos. Probably the first one would be just south of Cheyenne on the border facing Colorado, probably with a sign large enough to be seen in Fort Collins.
Not everyone agrees. Executive Director of the Wyoming Association of Churches, Chessie Lee, says gambling is a bad idea that hurts the poor, but she is most bothered by the state profiting from it.
You know, I can understand why people would want to see that as a source of revenue, but the lottery, for example, only about 25% of that income is going to come back to the state as state revenue. So it's not really a very efficient way for the state to raise money.
Wyoming Representative Nathan Winters of Thermopolis agrees. He says the potential for creating addicts outweighs any possible financial or recreational benefits.
Industrialized gambling is something that we should pay very careful attention to. I believe that it can be very damaging to our state if we pursue this very far.
Research on that subject is thin. Dr. Dean Gerstein is a researcher who led the only two nationally commissioned studies on gambling, the most recent in 1999. He says the consensus is that people of all income levels gamble at about the same rate. It's just that poor people can less afford it. He also says studies show there's a threshold for play.
When you first introduce a big increase in the level of availability of particularly commercial gambling opportunities like casinos opening, there's clearly an increase in interest and an increase in levels of gambling. A lot more money gets spent and a lot more addictive gambling arises. And then it appears that over time, people get acclimated to that level of availability, and you don't see a continued increase as the market saturates with vendors.
Wyoming's fairly isolated, says Gerstein, but it's not starting from zero, and many people may already be traveling to play in neighboring states, so it's hard to say how many people will become addicted once more gaming's introduced. But opponents Lee and Winters want answers, and hope Governor Matt Mead will follow through on his promise to monitor the effects of the upcoming lottery before opening up any further gaming opportunities in the state. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Sarah Hosseini.
When we come back, we'll talk with the new chairman of the Wyoming Democratic Party, and we'll talk about the rebranding of the national GOP. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. We're joined now by Pete Gosar. He's the new chairman of the Wyoming Democratic Party, and he says he's optimistic that the party will be able to gain a better footing in the state.
We've initiated a return to what we do best, and that's caring about people. Paul Wellstone had a nice comment and a quote, and I think it bears to on our future. It's, politics isn't about big money, and it's not about power games. It's about helping people. And so we've instructed all the counties, if they like, that to find a problem in their county and address it. And so if, for instance, hunger or child food scarcity is a problem, and quite honestly, it is a problem. 37% of the kids in Wyoming are on free and reduced lunch. Well, there are backpack programs throughout these counties, and be involved and be consistent involvement. And we think that being engaged and being part of the solution is a way to grow this party and help somebody out along the way.
But sort of on a more concrete level, what things are you planning to do to both make voters more receptive to the Democratic Party and maybe encourage more people to run as Democrats for public office?
Well, we're going to shed light on some of the stuff that we don't think many people agree with. And this referendum idea, House Bill 79, is just the first step. We don't think that those people in the legislature were sent to remove people's vacation pay or to impact it anyway. And so we think that maybe we should start solving those issues that we've struggled with in Wyoming, like the wage gap. Everybody talks about it, and if it was easy, it would have been solved. But, I think maybe the focus should have been spent on improving people's lives. And for instance, tipped workers, that's a great way to start with the wage gap. A high number of those, 75% or more, are women, and it's $2.10 an hour. I mean, that's just unacceptable. And if it takes having to add a quarter to my fare every time, well, let's do it, because it's money well spent to pay people a fair wage up front. And so I think the people of Wyoming, when they hear that and find out that the reports of our demise are greatly exaggerated, as they say, we'll now start to maybe think that there's a different way of doing business and maybe try to get involved with a party that actually stands up for people. And I think that you do the best messaging when you're out, helping a neighbor with a flood, or you help the soup kitchen with, getting their yearly donations. And so I think that's a big part. And I know a lot of people have rolled their eyes at me like, oh, that's not going to work. But, I would point to history and say, well, I don't know, maybe Gandhi or Chavez or some of those others would take a different view on that.
So really sort of very on the ground, like, let's go help people out in a concrete kind of way.
Right. And I think that we'll organize about that. I think that many times political parties are seen as people meeting once a month to talk about and solving the world's problems. And although there's an important place for that, I think that the better organizations actually do something. And so we're going to plan on doing something. And when that becomes successful, we're going to do other things. And we think that the outreach, people around, when they see Democrats always helping, I think they'll take another look at us. And I think that maybe some of the struggles that we've had has been an image problem.
One of the things that that we've heard multiple times is that it's sometimes just hard to get people to run as Democrats for elected offices. What can be done to encourage more people to run?
Well, I think that they see the numbers, and some of the times the numbers are misleading. And oftentimes we don't have a candidate in some of these rural counties, and so the people who want to be involved in elections, whether they support our views or not, they always register as Republicans. And so we need it to be a people that want to change something and are willing to endure maybe a loss or two, but we're there to support people and give them the opportunities, take the roadblocks down, whether it be money or it's a scary proposition. I can talk about just running for election. And I think once you get past that, you find that it's kind of liberating also.
So realistically, where do you see the Democratic Party in a few years down the road in Wyoming? I mean, can we expect big changes?
I tell people, and I know they look at me askance, but I would not get into this position if I didn't want to at some point have a Democratic-controlled legislature. And I know that's a long ways off, and but that's you should always set out with the goal to win. And so whether we pick up seats or solidify seats or we get more candidates at the local level, at the city council level, we're going to improve and we're going to become more organized. And, you know, we're going to try to change the idea that Democrats are from someplace else and that they only occupy one corner of this corner of the state. No, there's plenty of Democrats out there and they're your neighbors. And for too long, they've been quiet. But we're going to start waking up, I think.
Pete Gosar is the new Democratic Party chair. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Willow. I appreciate it.
National Republican leaders are doing some soul-searching after suffering losses in November. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington on what Wyoming Republican lawmakers think of the new effort.
The Republican National Committee says the GOP has a problem with women and minority voters. In assessing the party's lackluster showing in 2012, party leaders introduced a 219-point proposal to help soften the party's image, including doing better outreach in communities that are traditionally Democratic strongholds.
Absolutely, I agree with that.
That's Wyoming Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis. She says a part of the problem for the Republican Party is optics.
Our message, our fundamental American values should be appealing to women, to Hispanics, to Asians, to blacks. We talk about it wrong. We look like a party of white Americans. We look very male, and we don't address ourselves and our fundamental values to those communities.
Republicans felt the wind at their backs going into last year's presidential election. They trounced Democrats in the 2010 midterms, even regaining control of the U.S. House after just 4 years out of power. But the party did a lot worse than many Republicans expected in 2012, losing Senate and House races that many thought were a lock. As Wyoming's only U.S. House member, Lummis says the House losses were particularly hard to watch.
To be honest, and I hate to admit this, if you add up all the votes that Democrat House candidates got around the country versus all the votes that Republican House candidates got around the country, the Democrats won the popular vote.
Republicans were still able to retain control of the lower chamber in Washington because mostly Republican-controlled state legislatures redrew the maps for House districts across the nation, making them safer for the GOP. But the Senate and presidential losses are still stinging party leaders. Wyoming's John Barrasso is a part of the Republican leadership team in the Senate.
In this past election, it was pretty clear that the president won because many more people believed that he was for someone like them as opposed to the nominee from the Republican Party.
Barrasso says his party needs to do a better job connecting the dots for voters in the future.
People ask the question, what's in it for me? And I believe our policies are ones in terms of on jobs, on the economy, on the debt, and on the spending that are ones that are good for the country. We just need to make sure people understand why those policies are good for them personally and for their families.
The RNC proposal also calls on rank-and-file Republicans to get behind comprehensive immigration reform. Barrasso says he's waiting to see a specific proposal before he weighs in. But with the state's tourism and ranching industries impacted by the current immigration system, he says he's no stranger to the need for legal migrant workers.
I think that you want to try to compete effectively for every voter. And your policies want to be ones that, you know, improve the quality of life for all Americans.
As for the specifics, Congresswoman Lummis says she supports comprehensive immigration reform, but she's dubious of what some people mean by the term.
Now, if comprehensive means amnesty, then I'm not with that definition of comprehensive.
National GOP officials also want fewer presidential primary debates and want a shorter primary schedule. They're also calling on caucus states like Wyoming to move to a primary. State Republican leaders didn't return requests for comments on that proposal. But Lummis says instead of trying to dictate the mode of the election, party leaders ought to be looking for ways to bring Western concerns into the next presidential primary.
For example, campaigning in the Midwest and have then a regional Midwest primary, and then the Southeast and have a regional Southeast primary, and then the Rocky Mountain West or something like that, that allows candidates to concentrate on a geographic area and the issues that are important in that geographic area.
With Wyoming's three congressional lawmakers in safe seats, the RNC's rebranding effort is of less concern to them than to lawmakers in other states. But for their policies to get approved, they'll need their party to control more than just the House. And if the last election is an indicator, they say that a makeover could do their party good. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, we'll take a look at whether or not there's enough inspectors to monitor oil and gas operations in Wyoming, and we'll look at a wage situation in Sweetwater County. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. After decades of a boom and bust economy, officials in a town in southwestern Wyoming believe they may have harnessed the erratic cycle into more sustainable economic growth. Amanda LeClaire has more.
It's well known that during boom cycles here in the West, the jobs and the money are easy enough to come by. But with every boom comes a bust and the dark cloud of population loss, unemployment, and falling wages. Here in Rock Springs, though, city officials believe they finally transformed the dreaded boom and bust cycle into slow, sustained growth.
I mean, we're not really going through a boom right now. What we're doing is it's really sustainable growth. I mean, a boom is when you see things go up 10-15%. Our annual growth right now in Sweetwater County, population-wise, is between 1 and 1.2%, which is a good, steady growth, and that's what we like to see.
Dave Hanks is the CEO of the Rock Springs Chamber of Commerce. He says that despite the effects of a multi-year recession across the rest of the country, Rock Springs did not see the same levels of unemployment and the drop in housing prices other cities did. Hanks says that's in part due to the lessons learned during the past decades of sharp growth and sudden stops.
The good news is Wyoming and Rock Springs in particular have been through this many, many times. So we are prepared for that. We know how to adjust. We know what we need to do. We always build out additional infrastructure to accommodate that because we know what's going to happen. And I think the city and I think the counties have done our county has done a good job, and particularly Rock Springs, in anticipating future growth.
But while Sweetwater County hasn't been touched as greatly by the last recession, there's still a danger in relying too heavily on the extraction industry for local jobs. Doug Bunn is an associate professor in economics at Western Wyoming Community College. He says while there's been some diversification within the natural resources industry itself, it's not yet enough to guarantee an economy that's reliably stable.
I think that everyone would hope that things have improved, that we have seen a diversification a little bit. We still have the same core basic industries, I think, that we've had for the last 10 or 15 years. Maybe the dependence is a little bit different. There has been some expansion. It's a little less of an industrial town. We're seeing more retail, more merchandising. So the possibility is that, you know, maybe we've improved, but I'd say we're far from reaching a diversified economy.
Hanks adds that while traditional booms mean an influx in temporary workers that strain a town's resources, the good news is that it's not what happened over the last few years in Sweetwater County. He says the newest residents are often young families who buy homes and become long-term residents. Hanks says that difference brings an economic stability to the region, and that's good for those who come to the area for work in the natural resource industries and for those seeking work in the growing retail and food services. One of the county's major issues is actually a lack of available employees.
When you have 600, 700, at one time we had 1,000 jobs that were available here. You know, and if someone's paying $12, $13, $15, $18 an hour for an entry-level position, it's really hard to keep people, you know, working at, you know, restaurants and working in hotels and the hospitality sector and those type of things. That does have an impact at that level. But what the impact is, it drives those wages up.
Hanks says this has forced the retail sector to pay more to compete. But he notes the sector still has plenty of job openings, but those higher wages could play into Rock Springs' favor. According to a new study, paying higher wages in sectors like retail can add a significant boost to the local economy. Catherine Rushlin authored the study. She's a policy analyst at Demos, a New York-based think tank. She says that companies that offer higher wages to low-income workers often see an immediate increase in sales.
You know, in a time of low consumer demand, there's a huge potential for a wage increase to stimulate the economy through what we call the multiplier effect. And that is, when you raise wages at the bottom, those workers go out and spend their paychecks, That spending becomes somebody else's income, and a business sees their sales improve, maybe needs to give someone else a few extra hours on the clock, and the money goes back into new pockets and around the economy in that way.
Rushland says that according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, retail, which includes the food service industry, will grow to be the second largest source of jobs in the U.S. by 2020. Indeed, Hanks notes that they are getting more people moving into the community to take some of these retail jobs. Rushland says if higher entry-level wages continue to become expected in Sweetwater County, it could unexpectedly be a testing ground for a new business model in retail. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Amanda LeClaire in Rock Springs. A study by the U.S. Geological Survey looks at the ecological conditions that sage grouse need in order to survive, and the amount of human disturbance they can tolerate. We're joined now by Steve Knick, one of the report's authors. He says the goal was to determine the basic requirements that sage grouse have.
In other words, what do you need to support sage grouse? And so we used maybe just a little more complicated variation of the basic food, cover, space, and water that's in every biology class. And so we used 28 different variables and looked at how those varied across the sage-grouse range and identified this basic set that we call the ecological minimums. Once we had that, then we were able to map that and show places where the environment was suitable for sage-grouse, even though they may not be there, and not only suitable then, but over larger distances, how you might establish connectivity between different populations.
What were some of the key findings that you came up with in terms of, you know, these minimum requirements that sage-grouse have?
Probably the main one was how little disturbance sage-grouse would actually tolerate. And disturbance comes in many different forms, but one of them that we measured was human development. And there was very little human development within the areas around these leks. Development is things like cities and towns. So the result itself isn't all that surprising for a land cover called development. The other kind of human activities, though, that also were really low levels were things like power lines, communication towers, interstate highways. Sage grouse just didn't do well when you had a lot of those within that surrounding area.
Now, we've known for a while that sage grouse don't like human disturbance. So what exactly is new here?
Probably the level of the human disturbance was much less that they would tolerate than what we've probably known. And the implication then is, you know, how do we then manage the development of resources on these lands with conservation of sage grouse?
So what does research like this say about, for instance, Wyoming's core area policy?
I think it supports the concept that if you're going to try and maintain sage-grouse populations, you need to minimize disturbance to some extent within these, whether they're called core areas in Wyoming or priority areas for conservation in the range-wide, and all the other states have these kind of things as well. But the idea being that you try and minimize disturbance in these areas that are highly critical to sage-grouse.
What further research needs to be done about this?
I think some of the characteristics of disturbance itself, in that oil and gas wells and roads, whether it's communication towers, all have different characteristics. And understanding those characteristics is going to be important because we may be able to have different levels of these disturbance within areas as opposed to simply minimizing everything.
Is there any advice that you have for wildlife managers, given what you know now from this study?
Probably just to continue looking at ways to conserve some of the large areas of sagebrush that we currently have. It's given the characteristics of sagebrush, it's unlikely we're going to, say, grow large areas of new sagebrush that's undisturbed, which really places then an importance on those areas that we still have.
Okay, well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's fun to talk about this stuff.
Steve Knick is a researcher with the USGS, and he was working on a study about the minimum ecological requirements for sage grouse.
Oil and gas development in Wyoming has burgeoned in the last decade. The Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality, the Bureau of Land Management, the Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and sometimes other agencies are all responsible for inspecting the sites. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhuroff reports that some stakeholders say they're not doing a good enough job monitoring operators, but agencies say it's not that simple.
Jennifer Frazier is a Department of Environmental Quality oil and gas inspector. Frazier spends a lot of time in her truck. She makes rounds on the Jonah oil and gas field near Pinedale, driving up to the tanks that dot the horizon there and idling as she works.
I, as an inspector, go out routinely and ensure that nothing is leaking, basically.
If she sees or smells a leak, she pulls out her flare camera.
What I'm doing here is I'm just nuking the camera.
And records a visual of the fumes as evidence to send on to Cheyenne. She's responsible for Jonah Field, which has over 700 facilities. Last year, she visited about 80% of the sites and says that's good coverage. But a report put out by the Western Organization of Resource Councils, or WORC, says there aren't enough people like Frazier to go around. As of 2011, there were over 37,000 active oil and gas wells in the state. The Bureau of Land Management did about 8,000 inspections. The Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission did over 7,000, and Frazier's department at the DEQ did about 800. Even though development has increased over the years, the report says the number of inspectors hasn't kept up.
It would take the Land or BLM office over 9 years to do their inspections at current rates. They're not doing their job. It's just that simple. They're not doing their job.
That's Powder River Basin Resource Council member John Fenton. He lives in Pavilion with 24 wells on his property. And he says he's never seen an inspector, and that worries him.
It's not like this is just some benign, you know, facility sitting in my front yard. This is a giant explosive gas-producing facility with all sorts of toxins, all sorts of things that can go wrong. How can you get an idea of how well an operator is performing if you never do a damned inspection? We don't have inspections out here.
Turns out the wells in his area were last inspected between 2008 and 2010, but they were only inspected because complaints about them came in. The wells on Fenton's property aren't even required to be inspected because they're low emitters. Fenton says that's a loophole in regulations.
It's these little things that add up all the time.
Fenton says it's often the operator, in his case Encana, that's responsible for keeping its operations in compliance. Self-monitoring is something that both the DEQ and the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission rely on. Companies are supposed to check their equipment regularly, and Fenton says that's another problem.
I think it's insane. It's like leaving a bunch of kids in a room with a package of cookies and telling them not to eat the damn cookies.
But Frazier says that's not totally accurate.
Sometimes people get upset with that because they think it's the fox guarding the hen house, when it's actually not, because Brandy and I go out with these people and we train them on how to do things. And we go out and we audit how they're doing things. Sometimes we just are out there and we are watching them. And if they miss something, then we'll correct them on them.
One of her colleagues is less sure. John Walker is an air quality engineer who heads up a study on engine emissions in the oil and gas fields.
My personal opinion is if we want engines to be in compliance, I think the DEQ should be testing as well.
But Steve Dietrich, the air quality administrator for the DEQ, says that's not always possible. It comes down to resources.
Can you always use another hand anytime you ask a company or a state agency? The easy answer is yes, but that's not reality. And I think we have a pretty good balance with the staff that we have. And without actually being at each facility each day, I think we do a pretty good job of monitoring the situation statewide out there.
Dietrich says the number of inspections has tripled since 2003. Prioritization and planning in the various agencies happens differently at each one, though they all tend to place previously problematic facilities and operators at the head of the line. But, for example, though Fraser's area has nearly 50% of the state's gas and dehydration facilities, it only gets 24% of the inspectors. Still, she says the compliance has improved, as well as operators' responsiveness, and she's proud to be a part of that.
At one time, when I very first started working out here, I was like, what? You're talking about a leaking thief hatch? Yeah, all those thief hatches leak out there. Yeah, they do. And I'm like, well, you know, when you see 1,000 of them leaking like I do, then there's you're creating a problem. And so now that's just not the case anymore.
Still, while operators and agencies are working closer together to better monitor development, other stakeholders, like landowners, say their concerns are very real and need to be taken seriously. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
You can see Work's report on our website, WyomingPublicMedia.org.
When we come back, we'll hear about the difficulties some movie theaters in Wyoming are having as they attempt to convert to digital technology. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. For the last month, state officials have expressed concern about Wyoming's dry winter and the possibility of another bad fire season. But with the moisture the state has recently received, the question is whether that concern has been reduced. Bill Crapser is the state forester, and he says having more moisture has certainly helped.
I mean, we're up to almost 100% snowpack around the state. So if nothing else, we're going to have a shorter fire season this year than we had last year, because by this time last year, we were already seeing large fires. The moisture will slow up the kind of pre-green up fire season, and then as we move into the summer, it'll be kind of dependent on what happens in weather. With the weather for the next 3 or 4 months.
I know there's been an awful lot of concern whether or not you'll have enough funding to do what you need to do. If you have a repeat of last year, are you at all worried about that?
You know, with the work that the governor's office did, the work that the legislature did, I think we're in pretty good shape as far as this summer, particularly with the little bit later fire season that we're anticipating.
Last year was obviously, at least in my memory, about as bad as it's been in a while. But how do you rate how you did last year and how you attacked some of the fires? I know you've been doing a lot of training with teams around the state. Did that pay off, did you think?
It really did. I mean, if you look at last year's fires, the large fires caught a lot of the attention. But with the vast number of fires we had last year, we were about 98.5% successful in initial attack, which means 98.5% of the fires didn't burn past the first burning period. So that's a pretty good record, and a lot of that is just because of the volunteer fire departments around the state and the training that they've been able to get and the type of equipment that they have.
State Forester Bill Crapser visiting with us. One of the things we want to talk about, too, is some of the homeowners out there setting up defensible space and getting ready for that. Is this the time of year to start doing that?
It sure is. I mean, to start look at, you know, when you're doing your spring cleaning around your house to look at weeds or pine needles or leaves or any sort of thing that are built up, and the time to kind of think about fire season and to be proactive. When the fire's burning up close to your house, probably isn't the best time to be doing any fuels management.
So what do you want people to do?
You know, we have folks around the state, our district foresters, and most of the counties have fuel coordinators, and really just talk to them, look at the options for defensible space, for in some areas where it's more range and prairie land, just simple things like keeping their lawns mowed or the weeds behind the barn mowed down make a big difference.
And I've also heard that you might want to trim trees if they're very close to the house, especially if you're up in the mountains. Is that what you're looking at?
Yeah, and you know, thin them out a little bit, and then also doing some trimming. A lot of times if you have limbs all the way to the ground, we have what we call ladder fuels, and it allows the fire to burn up into the trees, where if it's pruned up a little bit, trimmed up a little bit, you can prevent a lot of that.
Will you be doing some more public education campaigns about all of these topics coming weeks?
Yeah, we're working with other agencies, and we are going to be doing some PSAs, and we have a lot of workshops planned this spring around the state on defensible space. This is also our fire training season. We have our big wildfire training weekend mid-May up at Camp Guernsey to kind of have a live fire training with a lot of fire departments from around the state. We are also, even with the snow we've had the last few weeks, we are bringing our heli-tac crew, our helicopter and fire crew that we have based in Glen Rock. We're bringing them on a little bit early this year. So they're ready to go as soon as we start having some fires for initial attack.
Bill Crapser, always a pleasure. Thank you for taking time.
Thank you a lot, Bob.
Going to the movies has been a favorite pastime since the dawn of film, but Hollywood studios expect to stop printing movies on actual film before the end of this year. They're switching over to a digital format, which requires all new equipment, and the cost of the transition is proving prohibitive for some small Wyoming theaters. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez filed this report.
See, they come in on these. These are the reels that they come in on. Then we take the film off of the reels and we put it on the platter. And so this particular movie was 7 reels.
Edie Rawlings owns the Ritz Entertainment Center in Thermopolis. She's unpacking the reels of the Oscar-winning Lincoln from a pair of boxes in the projection room at her single-screen movie theater. Like a handful of other theaters in Wyoming, the Ritz still shows movies on good old-fashioned 35mm film. Rawlings says she has to wait until after bigger first-run theaters use the reels before she can get them, and reels are getting scarcer.
we still have movies out there. But once Fuji quits making 35 millimeter film, then there won't be any movies available until we turn to digital.
It's a lot cheaper for Hollywood studios to make digital copies of a movie and send them around the country on tiny hard drives than to print and ship enormous and finite film reels. Some people argue that digital offers better sound and picture quality, too. Big theaters started switching out their film setups for digital about 10 years ago. According to industry estimates, about 85% of theaters in North America have digital systems now, and so they're getting ready to stop producing movies on film. But Edie Rawlings has a problem with this.
Well, we have to have a digital projector, we have to have a new screen, we have to have a new sound system. We have to basically change everything. And what that means to us is between $65,000 and $70,000.
She says it's money she doesn't have. Some theaters, however, did get help. Bill Campbell owns the Centennial Theater in Sheridan and converted to digital 2.5 years ago. He took advantage of a deal offered by the Cinema Buying Group. Under the virtual print fee rollout arrangement, studios used the money they saved from discontinuing reel printing to help pay for participating theaters to switch to digital systems. Campbell says it covered about 85% of his transition costs. But a lot of small theaters didn't qualify for assistance and were left to fend for themselves. Campbell says that was a short-sighted decision.
The people in the small towns, when they go to college and then move on to other places, if they're not in the habit of going to movies when they're young, they're not going to be in the habit of going to them when they're older, having jobs in big cities. And so it's important to keep the movie-going experience alive for everybody in the nation.
Many small theaters break even or make a small profit, but not enough for a one-time equipment upgrade of tens of thousands of dollars. A number of communities around Wyoming have pulled together to raise money for their theaters' changeovers. The nonprofit Laramie Film Society is dedicated to preserving Laramie's historic Wyo Theater and bringing critically acclaimed movies to the spring and fall film series there instead of the lucrative blockbusters that play in a first-run theater across town. The owners of the Wyo declined to comment for this story, but Film Society President Anna Barbier says her group has a plan to help cover the transition.
What we're throwing around is applying for different grants, doing a Kickstarter campaign. That's probably where the majority of the money is going to come from. We've looked at different theaters. There are theaters throughout the country that are doing a similar thing, and some have been more successful than others.
Fourscore and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth from this continent a new nation conceived in liberty but dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
That's good. Thank you.
Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived.
It's a good turnout for a Tuesday night at the Ritz Theater in Thermopolis. Moviegoers sit in the dark, munching popcorn and watching Daniel Day-Lewis pull off an impressive performance as Abraham Lincoln. Little flecks and squiggles from imperfections on the 35-millimeter film dance across his face. Thermopolis resident Pauline Denton says she and her girlfriends come to the movies every Tuesday. Aside from bars, she says the Ritz is a major gathering place in the small town.
As far as high schoolers, this is it. They go to the show either Friday night or Saturday night. It's one or the other. Because we don't have anything else to offer them. We really don't.
Ritz owner Edie Rawlings says they've raised about $13,000 of the $65,000 they need to switch to digital. She says efforts to secure grants and loans have fallen apart, and she's hoping a big donor will come along soon. For now, the film reels are still coming, and the old projector is still busy every night. Until that changes, she says, she isn't going to come up with a plan B. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Tara Orr is our web editor. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and other information, you can follow us on Twitter as well. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.